Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. As promised, Jimmy Akin for another hour with us. Jimmy, senior apologist here at Catholic Answers, the author of a whole bunch of things, including The Bible is a Catholic Book and A Daily Defense, 365 Days Plus One to Becoming a Better Apologist, and The Fathers Know Best, and that list goes on and on and on. You can find Jimmy's work on the internet as well. You can visit him at jimmyakin.com, where he has a good deal of writing there that's available to you, and you can get his podcast each Friday. Well, you can get it any day of the week, but the new episode drops each Friday at Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World. Jimmy, thanks for coming back for another hour.
My pleasure. I never left.
We got some compliments, by the way, on Facebook on your Superman shirt.
That's a fine
Superman shirt.
Thanks, everybody. You know, I had trouble back when I got this shirt back a number of years ago, and it just did not fit. And finally, I lost a bunch of weight. And guess what? Now it fits. So now I'm much happier with it than I used to be.
I use the other method where I just stretch it and stretch it and stretch it. And
That made it uncomfortable.
I like your method. You just slim down until you fit into your Superman shirt. Very good. I don't think I've ever asked you this, but are you more of a Superman than a Batman guy? Or do you go one way or the other on that?
I like them both pretty equally, I think.
Yeah.
I read both Batman and Superman.
All right. Fair enough. The number 888-318-7884, Jimmy Akin, the guest, and all of your questions, give us the content. So, if you've got a good one, give us a call. Open forum. By the way, I do want to stress this, and I think people know this too, because we've already had a Protestant gentleman call us up and tell us about his consideration of the Catholic faith. But you don't have to be Catholic. You don't even have to be Christian to call. Anybody is welcome to call with any question they've got. Let's start with Alex in Oregon this hour. We'll go. Alex is listening on the Catholic Answers Live app. Alex, your question for Jimmy.
Hi, Jimmy. Yeah. Well, one thing to say just at the beginning, I've been listening to Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World with my dad, and he and I have been enjoying that quite a bit. So
that would be awesome.
For that. But
who found it? You or your dad?
My question is, my sister, actually, and she got me into it, and now he's into it.
It's so a family
it's
affair.
Out of control.
Very good. Very good. All right. Sorry, I interrupted you. You started with your question.
Oh, no, you're good. So my question was kind of just about determining what media, film, and games are okay to play or watch, because the Catechism mentions that you should try to avoid things that are sexualized or things like that, but it isn't just black or white that way. It's actually very small where you find something that just has no sexualized content whatsoever. So I've been trying to sort of figure out, okay, well, how far do you have to go with that? And when do you know that you can just watch something or play something like that?
The underlying principle, and it's not just sex that it can be problematic. Any kind of sin can be problematic. Now, when it comes to media consumption, whether it's a book or a movie or a TV show or a game or whatever it may be, all of these different media depict humans in situations. They may be realistic situations, they may be fantastic situations, but they depict people in situations. And sometimes they depict people doing things that they shouldn't. And that of itself is not a problem, because if you were to cut out all media and just avoid all media that depicts human beings behaving badly, you would have to cut out the Bible, because the Bible is realistic about human sin, and it depicts people behaving badly. It depicts people killing when they shouldn't. It depicts people doing sexual things when they shouldn't. It depicts people lying and cheating and doing all kinds of things that they shouldn't. So we ourselves are not expected to avoid all reference to people behaving badly. God included people behaving badly in his inspired message to us in Scripture. And so now you can say, well, why did God do that? One of the reasons was as a warning to us to say, don't do these things. And so that gets us to the real core principle about whether or not it's going to be okay to consume a certain type of media. The answer is going to be whether, if God gave us scripture to warn us against these things, well, what's our reaction to a given piece of media? Are we being tempted to commit sin ourselves by it? And that's something that each person has to answer for himself, because different people have different temptations. And consequently, you have to look at your own heart and say, okay, am I being tempted to sin by this? And if it's yes, I am, and it's a strong temptation, and it's a mortal sin that I'm being tempted to commit, then you want to stay away from it. On the other hand, if maybe I'm having a little bit of temptation here, but I can just shrug it off, or it's just venially sinful or something like that, then the flee at all cost order is not in place. One of the things that that people have to bear in mind is that our goal as Christians is not to avoid all temptation, because temptation is built into us and it's built into life. And if you try to avoid all temptation, you're going to fail, because life involves interacting with people and things. And some of those people are sinners, most of them, I'm guessing. Also, some of the things are going to pose temptations on one level or another, even if it's a trivially small temptation. And even if you tried to shut yourself in a sensory deprivation tank, your own mind would come up with temptation. So rather than retreat from the world and not engage it and not do the good that we could do, our goal is not to run away from every temptation that's out there. Our goal is, in light of our knowledge of ourself and relying on God's grace, to manage the temptations that we encounter so that they don't become excessive, and so that we don't get led into sin, and especially not into mortal sin. So given all of that, one has to use the virtue of prudence to discern in a particular situation whether a certain piece of media is something that will pose temptations such that it needs to just be avoided, or whether it doesn't really pose that level of temptation, in which case, if it otherwise is something, a piece of media you would enjoy consuming, then it's okay to go ahead and read it or watch it or play it, provided that the temptation level it poses is manageable and you're not going to be led into grave sin as a result of it.
Thanks, Alex. Appreciate that call and that question. Got to go to a quick break. Jimmy Akin, our guest. It is open forum today, and the number 888-318-7884. I mentioned before, we got all of the 20 Answers books are just a buck, but guess what else we've got? You get 50% off all of our electronic materials right now. Hundreds of great resources to choose from over at shop.catholic.com. All the ebooks, the MP3s, the e-magazines. It's all 50% off, and that also goes for the rest of the month, I believe. Am I reading that correctly? Yes, I think so. Just go over to shop.catholic.com. You'll see a bunch of deals. You got the $1 20 Answers books, every single one of them is just a buck, and now you got 50% off all of the e-materials like ebooks, MP3s, and e-magazines at shop.catholic.com.
Did Jesus ever claim to be God, or did his followers later come to think he was divine, like it was for the Buddha? Critics of Christianity affirm the latter. But is this true? The answer is no, and here are some reasons why. First, the idea of Jesus' divinity had to have come from Jesus himself, because it doesn't make sense that faithful monotheistic Jews would just out of the blue begin thinking a man was God. Second, the Gospels record Jesus saying things that suggests his divinity. For example, he applies the divine name, I Am, to himself in John chapter 8, verse 58. Mark 2, 5-7 tells us Jesus merited the charge of blasphemy by claiming to have power to forgive sins. So, Jesus claimed to be God. That's a fact. But should we believe him? Well, that's a question for some other time. I'm Carlo Broussard with a ready reason for Catholic Answers, Catholic.com.
Ever wonder about the power of prayer? St. John Chrysostom states that prayer and converse with God is a supreme good. It is a partnership and union with God. As the eyes of the body are enlightened when they see light, so our spirit, when it is intent on God through prayer, is illumined by His infinite light. Let God's infinite light be your guiding light. Ask Him to guide you daily in your prayer, work, recreation, home life with family, and your friendships.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live, open forum. Jimmy Akin, our guest this hour, and around the world we go. Off to Chile now. Carissa in Chile, watching on YouTube Live, is next up. Carissa, your question for Jimmy.
Hi, thank you so much. I'm a huge fan. My question is, does formal heresy ipso facto depose a pope of his office? I've been talking a lot with my Sedevacantist friends, and this is an argument that I've constantly heard from them.
This is a question that is open in Catholic theology. There has been discussion of it in the past. One of the more extensive discussions of it that's available in English is by St. Robert Bellarmine. And he wrote a series of different works that are available now in English translation. And in his volume on the papacy, he considers this question. He sketches out five or six different opinions that different thinkers have taken on this. And he then weighs in on them and gives his opinion, though it's only his opinion as a theologian. The church does not have a teaching on this. And so it is in the realm of theological opinion. There are certain things that one would need to make certain of, even if formal heresy did lead to a pope losing office. Number one, it would have to be formal, as you say, meaning the pope knowingly, deliberately, and culpably is saying something heretical. Number two, it would have to be manifest, because under canon law, penalties do not apply to if you just have a heretical thought in your heart, but you never say it out loud, the penalty of excommunication does not apply. So thinkers on this subject have agreed it would need to be a manifest heresy. And most fundamentally, it would need to be a heresy. And that's something that a lot of people do not understand. People have the idea that a heresy is any given thing that they say that's contrary to what they perceive church doctrine to be. And that is not remotely close to true. You have to do way more than deny a point of Catholic doctrine for it to be a heresy. Now, denying a Catholic doctrine is bad, but heresy is reserved for one particular kind of denial. That kind of denial is if you say that something the church has infallibly defined to be divinely revealed. If you do not refuse to believe something the church has infallibly defined to be divinely revealed, then that would be a heresy. But the vast majority of church teachings have not been infallibly defined, much less have they been infallibly defined to be divinely revealed. So you can't grab some teaching from some era of church history and just say, hey, you deny this, you're a heretic. That's not the way it works. You have to carefully verify the criteria. Has there been an actual definition, like from a pope or a council, that this is not only true, but that it's divinely revealed? And so I talk about this, by the way, in my book, Teaching with Authority, where I go into how church teaching works and how to identify heresy and how a lot of people today are seeing heresies where there ain't no heresies. So it's an open question. Some theologians would say, yeah, if a pope did commit manifest formal heresy, he might lose his office. Others would say, no, that wouldn't happen. That's an open question in theology. But fortunately, we are not in that circumstance. And unfortunately, the seat of a contest folks that are out there today do not have an accurate appraisal of the current situation, and they frequently misunderstand both the nature of heresy and when something is and is not infallibly defined. And that's one of the key things that leads them astray.
Thank you, Chris. I appreciate that call from Chile and that question. Jimmy Akin, our guest, it's open forum. Got to move on now to Robert in Oklahoma, listening on the EWTN app. Robert, your question for Jimmy.
Hi, guys. Thanks for taking my call. I was wondering, since God lives in eternity, if our prayers are, since there's no time restraint on God, if our prayers today are efficacious for our ancestors, then we never move. And should that be considered in regards to purgatory?
Okay, so so the basic answer to your question, in my opinion, is yes. And so we can pray for people in the past, either by name or generically. And it could be our own ancestors, even if we never met them. It could be anybody in the past, precisely because God is outside of time, and therefore he hears our prayers right now, in the eternal now that he exists in, and he's got all of history in front of him, and he sees us in 2020 making the prayer, and he can apply his grace to any period in history that he chooses. So if I'm, let's say, now my name, my literal name on my birth certificate is Jimmy, not James, but there was a James Akin who was one of my ancestors back in the 1600s. And needless to say, I never met that James Akin, but I can pray for him and God can benefit him and all my other ancestors. In fact, I actually do pray for my ancestors, although I tend to only name the ones that I personally knew, and I pray for the others more generically. This would be true even if God weren't eternal, even if he weren't outside of time. All God has to be able to answer prayers in this way, is omniscient. So, Psychelet, is God omniscient?
Yes, he is, Jimmy.
Yeah, so he knows everything.
Right.
So if I pray for the James Akin that lived back in the 1600s in the year 2020, if I'm praying in 2020,
right,
did God know that back in the 1600s that I would one day make that prayer?
Yes, because it's part of everything.
Yeah, so God knows it. So God, even if God weren't outside of time, even if God literally existed in time in the 1600s, he would have known that I'm going to be praying in 2020 for James Akin. And he could therefore apply his grace to James Akin in the 1600s, even if he weren't outside of time altogether. But he is outside of time altogether. And consequently, that's all the more reason that he sees all the prayers in all of history and can apply his grace whenever and wherever it's needed. And that's not just my opinion. That was also, it just happened to be the opinion of the Protestant author C.S. Lewis, who talks about this. And it was the opinion of the Catholic saint Padre Pio, who made the same point. And there's also indications of this in the writings of Saint Faustina Kowalska. And in terms of, does it apply to helping people in purgatory? Absolutely, yes. If you look at Benedict XVI's encyclical on Christian hope, Spes Salvi, he talks about this, and he says that because purgatory cannot be measured in terms of earthly time, it is never too late to pray for a loved one, because God transcends time, and he can help that person with their purification whenever they needed it, however time works in the afterlife.
Okay, Robert?
That's great. Thank you a lot.
That is great. Thank you very much, Robert.
By the way, if you want to read more about that, just Google Jimmy Akin and praying across time.
All right. And do you happen to know, Jimmy, what your ancestor James Akin did for a living?
In that case, actually, there were a bunch of Jameses. James and William are both traditional names in my family.
Oh, okay. All right. Again, Robert, thank you for that question. We'll go to New York now for our next question. Aries in New York, you are up next. Your question for Jimmy Akin.
Hey, guys. My question is just, I was watching this discussion on Hank Hanegraaff's YouTube with Francis Chan on the Eucharist. And, you know, one of the points that he made, you know, knowing that he is a convert to Eastern Orthodoxy, he said that, like, in what differentiates, of course, you know, between the West and the East is that it's the issue of transubstantiation, actually more specifically the issue of defining the mystery of the trans presence.
So, it's just a little bit hard to hear you. So I just want to, Hank Hanegraaff, who is the Bible answer man who became Orthodox, you were listening to his podcast, and he was saying that there's a difference in the definition of transubstantiation between the Orthodox and the Catholics.
Well, it's not in definition, if by definition you mean an infallible act of teaching. So
okay.
In historic Christianity, whether East or West, everybody agrees that Jesus is really present in the Eucharist, body, blood, soul, and divinity. He's there. The question is, what's the mode by which he's there? Is he maybe in with and under bread and wine, or does the bread and wine become his body and blood, or precisely how does that work? Transubstantiation is the view that the substance, the reality of the bread and wine becomes the body and blood of Jesus. So there's no more bread and wine there. And in the East, they haven't settled that question one way or another. Exactly. They know he's really there, but they haven't defined precisely how that works to the extent that it's been defined here in the West. Because here in the West, since the 1200s, it has been defined that that the Eucharist involves actual transubstantiation. The substance or reality of the bread and wine ceases to be there and gives way or becomes Christ's body, blood, soul, and divinity. So we have a more precise expression in the West of how the real presence works, whereas in the East, they believe in the real presence, but they haven't determined it as specifically. Now, in terms of why that's the case, it's somewhat difficult to answer. I mean, part of the answer is just the history of doctrinal development in the West and the East is different. And Easterners have not felt the need to define this matter precisely. However, in the West, there was a controversy over this. And in the Western Church, there was a felt need to go ahead and settle this question to deal with the controversy. And so that's the basic answer. It's just a different level of perceived need historically to deal with it.
Great. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. And thanks for mentioning Hank Hanegraaff, the Bible answer man.
Yeah.
Now, Jimmy, I can't remember if you know him personally. I know you've enjoyed his work, but you know Hank.
No, I was on the Bible Answer Man years and years ago, back when he was still an evangelical.
Yeah, and he did he was very gracious and did an interview with us for Catholic Answers Focus when he first received the sacraments. What a very, very he was just a very nice person to talk with.
He's always been very nice to me. I'd love to be on the air with him sometime.
Yeah. I think he might be that way because he takes the Bible seriously. He reads the Bible and he takes it seriously.
Yeah. So do I.
Yeah. So that's well, you're a very nice person too, Jimmy. I'm sorry if I haven't said that enough, but you're a very nice person.
Well, that wasn't what I meant, but I mean, he's the Bible. He's known as the Bible Answer Man, and I'm the guy at Catholic Answers that does your Bible question shows.
Exactly.
So there's some commonality there, and it would be neat to have an on-air reunion with him. No pressure, but hint.
There's a hint. If you're listening, Hank Hennegraaff, the Bible Answer Man. Our number 888-318-7884. It's open forum. Jimmy Akin is our guest. Jimmy is senior apologist here at Catholic Answers. As a matter of fact, Jimmy's been explaining and defending the Catholic faith for more than 26 years.
27.
More than 27 years. So, you know, you can count on Jimmy's answers then. I just want to let you know before we send you off to the break, you do want to visit shop.catholic.com. We do have all of those great deals, including the $1 copies of the 20 Answers books. And we have all of our ebooks, MP3s, e-magazines, and all the electronic stuff, all the stuff that can just be delivered to you digitally. It's all 50% off. So find your way over to shop.catholic.com for some really great deals. We still got a half hour left, so if you're on the line, stay on the line. If you haven't dialed yet, I want to encourage you, but the lines have stayed pretty full. You can try 888-31-TRUTH.
Catholic Answers Live.
Did you know you can access Catholic Answers Live right from your phone or other mobile device? Download the Catholic Answers Live app today. The Catholic Answers Live app, available now on iOS and Android.
A few minutes each week with our podcast, Catholic Answers Focus, will help you understand and defend your Catholic faith like a boss. Get it wherever you get your podcasts or listen anytime at CatholicAnswersFocus.com. We Catholics just celebrated the Assumption and Coronation of Mary, so we asked Father Hugh about these important feasts, and he ended up telling us some really cool things about Mary going to heaven and being crowned queen. Also this week, the Catholic Church teaches that our justification, which can also be called getting right with God, is not a one-time thing but a process. But the letter to the Romans seems to imply that our justification might just be a one-time event. Carlo Broussard explains the truth about what St. Paul taught and why the Catholic Church gets this one right. Catholic Answers Focus is free, brand new twice a week, and now available on YouTube.
How can a human woman be God's mother? Where in the Bible does it say that Mary was sinless and a perpetual virgin? What can I do to build and deepen my relationship with Mary as my spiritual mother in heaven? In 20 Answers Mary, you'll find biblical evidence for Marian doctrine and devotion, answers to common objections to Catholic teachings about Mary, and guidance on how to imitate Christ as you get to know the Blessed Mother like you've never known her before. 20 Answers Mary is part of the 20 Answers series from Catholic Answers, offering hard facts, powerful arguments, and clear explanations of the most important topics facing the Church and the world, all in a compact, easy-to-read package. Visit shop.catholic.com today and take a look at this exciting new series from Catholic Answers Press.
This is Dr. David Anders. Is God an angry God?
We answer questions like these every day on Call to Communion, tomorrow at 2 p.m. Eastern.
Now, back to Catholic Answers Live.
Love that groovy music. Good dancing, Marie. Assistant producer Marie. She's been dancing since she got married, though, so doesn't count. A little bit of groovy music. Jimmy Akin here. All the lines full. It's open forum. You just can't ask for more on a Thursday. So let's go to Elizabeth in North Carolina, watching on YouTube Live. Hi, Elizabeth in North Carolina. You got a question for Jimmy?
Yes. So all over social media, I've seen like people claiming to have dreams about like the rapture and the end times. And so I have like two questions about it. So should we take what they've had dreams or claimed to have dreams about to be true? And do you think that we are living in the end times at the moment?
Okay, so let's deal with the second question first. And this is just my personal opinion because the Church doesn't have a teaching on this. But based on my assessment of the evidence, I do not expect the end of the world to occur in my lifetime. Obviously, we're closer to the end than we used to be. This is something that St. Paul himself says in his letters, that, you know, our redemption is closer now than when we first believed. So we're always getting closer, but that doesn't mean we're right at the end. And the track record of people who have predicted that we're right at the end has been dismal. In fact, so far, everybody who has predicted that we're right at the end has been wrong. And that includes all the people in history who had dreams about us being at the end. All of those dreams turned out to be wrong. And so there are some signs that will precede the end. One of the most notable ones is there's going to be a very notable large-scale conversion of Jewish people to the Christian faith, such that St. Paul says, as a result of that, all Israel will be saved. Now, there's room for some flexibility here, but there's going to be some kind of large-scale Jewish conversion, and that hasn't happened yet. And it would take some time for that to happen. I mean, barring a really miraculous intervention. And so consequently, just based on the history of how these predictions have worked out and based on my current reading of the situation, I don't expect the end of the world in my lifetime. But in terms of people having dreams, well, the first thing to note is this is all anecdotal. We don't have a scientific survey showing that people are having any more apocalyptic dreams now than they have had in the past. So, you know, just from a few accounts you read on social media or rumors that you hear on social media, that doesn't give you a solid basis for even thinking there has been a spike in such dreams. And frankly, it wouldn't surprise me if there were at least a little bit of a jump in such dreams this year, because we're living in the middle of a pandemic and there's violence in the streets and there's tensions around the world. And whenever things get bad, people think maybe this is the end. Well, even though God can send people dreams and that can tell you about the future, most dreams are not sent by God, even when they describe or seem to describe future events. What scientists have found is that most of our dreams are extensions of things that we're thinking about in everyday life. In particular, they tend to involve things that we worry about in everyday life. So if you're worried about something, if you're really worried about it, odds are you're going to have some dreams about it. You may or may not remember them, but you'll dream about it. And there's a good reason for that. This is something that God has built into our nature. When we dream about something that we're worried about or that we're afraid of, it's like being in a safe environment because it can't hurt you. It's just a dream. So it's like being in a safe environment where you encounter your fear. And what that does on a subconscious level is help you figure out how to handle yourself emotionally if you had to confront your fear in waking life. And so it's kind of like a practice simulation to help get you ready for something that you're afraid of in case it happened in real life. And so in a year where there's a pandemic and there's violence and there's all kinds of bad stuff going on, it's natural for some people to think, hey, maybe this is the end, and they get worried about that. And so they start dreaming about it because that's what dreams do. They confront you with things that you're worried about. And so I would expect there to be at least a little bit of a bump in the number of people who are having dreams like that this year for purely natural reasons, not because God's sending them a private revelation, but just because that's how the brain works. And so that answers a good chunk of the question. Now, you mentioned the rapture specifically. Catholics don't tend to use the word rapture. There is an event that St. Paul talks about in 1 Thessalonians 4 that some in the Protestant community call the rapture. What this event involves is all the believers being caught up to be with Jesus. The question is, what happens next? According to people who tend to use the term rapture, Jesus will then take all of those people back to heaven for a period while things get even worse on earth, and then he'll come back down and reign for 1,000 years, typically said to be reigning from Jerusalem. That's not accurate. If you actually study what St. Paul has to say about this. The event where we all get caught up to be with Jesus occurs right at the end, at the second coming itself, and Jesus will then come down from heaven, and he'll judge the living and the dead, and will and bring in the new age, the eternal order of things. So that is a different event. And so if people are having this other dreams about this other idea of the rapture, that it's like sometime before the real second coming, sometime before a 1,000-year reign of Christ on earth, then those dreams are clearly wrong, because that's not what's going to happen. And in all probability, most of the dreams that people are having are just going to be produced by natural subconscious processes as people are given a dream confrontation with their fears, because that's what dreams do much of the time, is they confront us with the things we're worried about to give us some practice on a subconscious level with the, with our worries and fears.
Does that help, Elizabeth?
Yes, it does. Thank you so much.
All right. Thank you so much. It's open forum. Jimmy Akin, our guest. Now we go to Michigan. David in Michigan, watching on YouTube Live. You are next. Your question for Jimmy, please.
Hi, Cy and Jimmy. I was just curious about someone was having a conversation with me saying that the Bible says you should never make a vow to God. Well, I thought that was maybe taken out of context, and so I was just curious, what is the view on, you know, taking a vow to God, and then also how does that look with, like, religious life, religious orders in particular?
So Jesus, the passage you're probably thinking of is found in the Sermon on the Mount, and Jesus says, you know, you have heard that it was said you need to pay your vows to God, but I tell you, don't swear at all. Just let your yes be yes and your no be no. And what Jesus is referring to is the fact that people would carelessly invoke God. I mean, they would say things like, oh, swear to God, blah, 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 blah. And they would kind of carelessly invoke God in a not really serious way. And that's what he's trying to rule out. So he says, look, you don't need to do that. Just let your yes be yes and your no be no. Just tell the truth. You don't need to use all of this additional language, especially in a careless fashion. But there are situations in which it can be done carefully and reverently. And we do at times see, for example, St. Paul writing under the inspiration of the Holy Spirit, doing exactly that, where Paul will say, God witnesses this thing I'm telling you. God is my witness. I'm telling you the truth. And so there can be situations, as the inspired author St. Paul shows us, where it can be legitimate to invoke God to testify in a solemn way to something that we're saying, the fact that it really is the truth. What you don't want to do is do that unnecessarily and flippantly or frivolously. So that deals with part of the question. Now, in terms of vows, well, vows worked multiple, there are multiple different types of vows in the Bible and in history. And Jesus does not have a problem with the concept of certain vows. We know that because certain vows are endorsed by God. If you look in the Old Testament, there is a vow known as the Nazirite vow, which was a way that men and women could consecrate themselves to God, either for a period of time or on a permanent basis. And so that's the equivalent of monastic vows that are either temporary or permanent. And the connection between the Nazirite vow and modern religious order vows is so close that in modern Hebrew, the word for monk is Nazir, and the word for nun is Nazirah. And so it's so clear that these are monastic type vows where you consecrate your God in a, to your, yourself to God in a special way, that even modern secular Hebrew people, Hebrew speakers, recognize that this is the same basic concept as becoming a monk or a nun, and this vow was endorsed by God. Part of that vow involved at the beginning of your time as a Nazirite, and again at the end of your time as a Nazirite, shaving your head as a sign of your consecration to God. And then the whole time you were a Nazirite, you weren't allowed to cut your hair, and your hair became a sign of consecration to God. Well, we know that even in New Testament times, people would take this vow because St. Paul did. Luke refers in the book of Acts to an instance where Paul shaved his head because of a vow he had taken. And he doesn't stop to explain it, but based on the Old Testament background, we know that Paul, therefore, for at least a time, had consecrated himself as a Nazirite. And so even in the New Age, even in the Christian age, this is something that is legitimate, and we see the apostles themselves doing things like this. And so Jesus doesn't have a problem with vows, provided they're done reverently and in the right context, but he doesn't want to see people doing them flippantly and things like that.
Thanks so much, David. I hope that that was helpful to you. We got to take a quick break. We'll be right back with more Open Forum with Jimmy Akin.
Let us help you with your question today on Catholic Answers Live.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects home buyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
A lot of people think that street evangelization involves yelling out of a bullhorn telling people that they're going to hell. Not so with St. Paul's street evangelization. Our methods are non-confrontational and effective. We simply offer information on the Catholic faith along with rosaries, miraculous medals, and prayer. Pope Francis wrote about how beautiful it is to see street preachers joyfully bringing Jesus to every corner of the earth. Street evangelization is fun and fruitful. Join us today at streetevangelization.com.
The wisdom of Mother Angelica.
Don't you feel sometimes like there's so many people in the world, how does he hear your prayer? Never think of that, huh? Everybody thinks of that. I'm only a little grain of sand on the seashore. Oh, but that's not true. See, God is God. And you and I have to let God be God. I don't know how he does it. He's God.
For more information on Mother Angelica, visit Religious Catalog at EWTNRC.com.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live, Open Forum with Jimmy Akin. So many folks on the line. It's been a long time since we've taken questions from Facebook or YouTube. So let me take one from Facebook, because a gentleman from Ethiopia, Abby from Ethiopia, asks you, Jimmy, can you please explain 2 Samuel 24:1 and 1 Chronicles 21:1? Who incited to count the fighting men of Israel? I'm struggling to find an answer. Please help.
Okay, so what Abi's referring to is the incident in Israel's history where King David took a census of all of the men who were available for military service, so he would know exactly how strong his potential force was that he could use in warfare against other kings. And this is recorded in more than one passage. It's recorded from one perspective in the books of Samuel and from another perspective in the books of Chronicles. So we get two different viewpoints on this, two different presentations of it. Now, in one of them, it says God stirred up David's heart to do this. And in the other, it says the devil stirred up David's heart to do this. What's the truth here? Well, it could be, just based on the language, it could be that God caused the devil to cause David to do this. But there's a problem with that view. It would make God the author of sin, because one of the things that is made apparent in both Samuel and Chronicles is this was a sin. and God ends up punishing David because of his sin. And we know that God is not the author of sin. As the book of James says, God does not tempt anybody. He doesn't lead anybody into sin. So whatever else you may think in interpreting a passage, it does not mean God caused somebody to sin. And so that tells us the real solution here. One of the things you find when you study Old Testament language is that it, because they want to depict God as a strong king, he's the heavenly king, he's in charge of everything, they talk about God as if he causes everything. But it's not literally true that God causes everything. Some things he just allows, but to depict God in this very strong, powerful way, they speak as if God caused it. And so that's what's happening here. Really what's happening is God is allowing the devil to tempt David into taking a census when he shouldn't. But because the author wants to depict God as being very strong from his heavenly throne, he speaks as if God caused this, when really God just allowed it, as we can infer from the fact that God does not lead anybody into sin. He does not tempt people, as James says, and so God is not the author of sin. That would be inconsistent with God himself being perfectly holy. What the other biblical author then does is clarify that it wasn't God who really did this, not literally, it was the devil who did it. And so we have both perspectives shedding light on different aspects of the situation. It was the devil who did it literally, and God allowed that. But the fact God allowed it gets expressed in a kind of hyperbolic or poetic figurative way.
Abby, I hope that helps you. Thanks for listening from Ethiopia. We understand it's hard to call from Ethiopia, so thanks for posting your question to Facebook. Let's go now to Jesus in El Paso, Texas, watching on YouTube Live. Jesus, your question for Jimmy.
Yes, hello.
Hello.
Yes, my question probably pretty simple, but it's a clarification. There are, I guess, two ideas where Jesus was crucified, where the nails were placed either on the palm, the hand, or the wrist.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Okay. So the question is, was Jesus crucified with nails through the palms or through the wrists? And some people have very strong opinions about this. You will find people who will say, well, it couldn't have been through the palms because the weight of the human body will not be supported if you just put nails through the wrists. And this is a little bit gross, but if they tried to crucify him just through the wrists, he wouldn't have stayed on the cross. I'll put it that way. Now, the problem is, and so therefore it must have been through the wrist rather than through the palms. The problem with that is the Romans didn't crucify people the same way all the time. They sometimes would crucify you and then tie your arms to the crossbeam with ropes. And if they did that, well, then they could have crucified him through the palms and then just tied his arms with ropes to help keep him up there. Other people would dispute the idea altogether and say, you can crucify somebody through the wrist and they'll stay up on the cross. So you can't really settle it by appealing to that. You also can't really settle it by appealing to the language that gets used, because the term hand in Greek has enough flexibility, it could include the wrist. So you can't settle it just by looking at the language either. Some people have tried to settle it by looking at the Shroud of Turin. And if you think that the Shroud of Turin is the authentic burial cloth of Christ, that would be a good place to look. But the problem there is that also seems to be ambiguous. There are some people who look at the Shroud of Turin and say, it's the palms or it's the wrist, or maybe it's both. Maybe it's kind of the wrist at an angle that then comes out through the palms that then is at an angle that comes out through the wrists. So the short answer is we don't really know. It could be either one.
Okay, Jesus?
Okay. Well, thanks a lot.
All right. Thank you very much. Let's go to Brian in Richmond, Virginia, also watching on YouTube Live. Brian, your question for Jimmy.
Hey, can y'all hear me?
We can, yes.
Okay. My question has to do with marriage. So
okay, what is it?
It's my understanding that the church teaches that marriage brings a man and a woman together for the reason of procreating and bringing children up. So I was wondering if a man or a woman are biologically unable to have children, where would that place them in the institution of marriage?
Okay. So what you said is true. Marriage does bring a man and a woman together for purposes of procreation, but not only for purposes of procreation. It's also for the good of the spouses. And that's something, it's in the Code of Canon Law. Pretty sure that same passage is quoted in the Catechism. But marriage, the way canon law defines it, is a union of the whole of life between a man and a woman for the good of the spouses and the procreation and education of offspring. So even if you can't have offspring for biological reasons, whether it's congenital infertility or you're just past the age of childbearing, you can still go ahead and get married for the benefits that it brings to both of the spouses. And that's always been recognized down through church history. People who were widows and widowers, even past the age of childbearing, they've always gotten married. There's never been any controversy about that. It's perfectly acceptable. And the same thing is true if you have modern testing abilities that would show, oh, well, this person can't have children. It doesn't matter. They're just in the same condition that people get to eventually in their lives. They just got there a little earlier from one reason or another, because if you live long enough, sooner or later, you won't be able to have kids anymore. And some people are just there earlier than others, but you can still get married for purposes of the benefit of the spouses.
Thank you very, very much, Jimmy Akin. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
That was a great pleasure. Tomorrow is Friday. That means Jimmy Akin's episode of Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World will drop. This is a freaky ghost story, one of the freakiest ghost stories, and it's possibly true. So you want to catch that at Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World tomorrow. Also tomorrow on this program, 2 hours with Carlo Broussard. We haven't seen Carlo in a long time. He'll be back. We're going to talk about heaven, hell, and purgatory, and then it's game show time. See you then, God willing, right here on Catholic Answers Live.